The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Kate, this is politics. Perception is reality. The truth won't matter.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, March the 20th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's just right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Contrary to the assertion expressed in our show opener today, namely that, quote, this is politics, perception is reality, and the truth won't matter, end quote. Well, the truth does indeed truly matter in politics, so much so that political interests which are not aligned with truth go to such great lengths to hide and or misrepresent the truth. This is a feat that is accomplished primarily through the manipulation of language and the redefinition of long-understood words and terms. The real and sad truth behind the statement that the truth doesn't matter in politics is that in the realm of politics, even when the truth is told, most people cannot recognize it or distinguish it from all of the other perceptions about politics and politicians that are not factual or true. The average person does not understand political language, nor the nature of politics, and is therefore made a victim of politics for every waking moment of every day. So I thought I would take some time to reflect and elaborate on some of the recent issues that we've been discussing on the show. There were a number of key or critical ideas and distinctions that require such elaborations because they are so powerful and so fundamental to understanding politics itself, and more to the point, to understand how and why people vote the way they do. It all gets underway right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, last week we discussed the concept of political atheism, quote-unquote, and the loss of faith in democracy. And, you know, the word democracy itself, so loved and promoted by the left, is one of the key concepts we'll be looking into later as the show progresses. So, could you be a political atheist without even knowing it? Political atheists, as I described earlier, are those who have either completely lost their faith in what they believe to be the democratic system, or never had such faith in the first place. And unfortunately, most of these people tend to be found on the broad right side of the polarity. Unlike those on the left, who remain eternally and consistently politically active and therefore monopolize the electoral process, too many on the right remain uninvolved in any meaningful political process. They may vote during elections from time to time, but even then, they end up voting for candidates of the left. The leftists they consider to be, quote-unquote, the lesser of a given number of evils. And even when a true, identifiable freedom candidate of the right is on the ballot, most right-wingers still vote left. You know, he'll never get elected. That's the attitude. And then there are those who never vote or never participate in politics whatsoever. Now, taken together, these voters and non-voters alike can be considered to be what I've been calling political atheists, in that they really have no faith in the possibility that anything positive can result from politics. And given the zeitgeist of the day, this is an understandable, however false, belief. The one reality about politics that no one can escape is the fact that even if you're not interested in politics, politics is always interested in you. In fact, it's after you all the time. Those who regard themselves as apolitical are in fact no less political than any political zealot. Being apolitical is just another political ideology. And I say this from personal experience. I once regarded myself as being apolitical right up to the day that I was asked and agreed to be a candidate in a federal Canadian election. But my interest was never directly in politics per se, but in freedom. And I soon learned that we can't have the latter without participating in the former. There are now calls for destroying all elements of the democratic voting process, the abolishment of political parties, and the establishment of variant forms of direct democracy and proportional representation. None of these suggestions can possibly lead towards a free society and will always lead towards tyranny. Despite all the flaws and incidents of election fraud associated with our current general process of electing representatives, there is no need to change the system in any fundamental way. What needs to be changed is how voters cast their ballots, and that requires quite a bit of persuasion. Yet more and more people are asking, why we keep getting the most corrupt people in government? How come that keeps happening? Well, the reason is self-evident, because a majority of voters vote for them. Why does nothing change for the better? Because the people voted in are the same people who were in government during a previous administration, or at least represent the same parties that were in a previous administration. Is there a political solution? One that can move us in the right direction, towards freedom instead of away from it? Yes, there is. We can elect people who aren't corrupt, and whose parties and platforms support individualism, freedom, and capitalism. That's the only way. But instead of voting responsibly, many atheist voters of the right now want to change the entire democratic structure in a delusional expectation that this can possibly change how people vote. None of them wants to accept the responsibility for supporting all of the corruption through their otherwise imperfect but adequately functioning electoral system. So instead of blaming themselves, they blame the system. They're blaming, they're blaming an object, which is the given electoral system or process, instead of the nation's subjects. There's a simple political solution to ending our tyrannical zeitgeist, but for most, it's not an easy one. The perpetual struggle for freedom requires an established means of eternal vigilance, which requires political parties and individuals committed to that objective, not just during elections, but most importantly, between elections. But as far as voting goes, the solution's as simple as this. Those on the right must stop voting for leftists and the lesser evils and vote only for those candidates and parties they know are just right. Now, I recall when a friend of mine, the late Dick Field, a longtime conservative who appeared on Just Right and who later became a supporter of the Freedom Party of Ontario, told about the explanation given to him by an Ontario Progressive Conservative Party MPP, a member of provincial parliament, who was a personal friend of his, about why that party never voted for or supported anything conservative in the legislature. They would always toe the liberal left line. And he's quite blunt about it. He told Dick that conservative voters always vote for their conservative party, no matter how socialist the conservatives get. And you can't get more socialist than actually naming your party a progressive conservative party. As long as that word conservative is in there somewhere, the rest doesn't matter, because they don't know what any of the other political words mean or imply. Because in today's political lexicon, progressive, quote-unquote, is merely another redefined term meaning socialist or collectivist. So appealing to conservatives was unnecessary, since they always blindly voted conservative, perfect examples of people I would classify as political atheists. They don't really believe in anything that has to do with real conservative principles. If such a thing even exists, you'd never know it from their behavior. And as if to offer us a perfect illustration of this phenomenon, on this side of our upcoming bumper, Greg Wycliffe, on his March 15th posting online, referred to the Conservative Party of Canada, the CPC supporters, as being scaredy cats, which might be an adequate term to refer to their motivation, fear, but not to their real political identities as political atheists. And on the return side of the bumper, on a March 14th Joe Rogan Experience, during which Joe Rogan was speaking with James Lindsay, they identified the term ideology with a cult, and that was a word we discussed earlier too. And again, that's quite true, but does not identify the source of ideological cultish thinking, as we will when we return. But first, here's Greg Wycliffe.
Conservative Party of Canada, the CPC supporters, are they're scared pussies, and they might end up being just as bad, or worse, than Trudeau supporters. You know how Trudeau supporters are kind of like these, like, it's Trudeau, I just love Trudeau. You know, that is unhealthy because it becomes this kind of crazy cult. And I see that forming around Poilievre, and it's going to be just as bad, guy. I was on the phone making fun of a friend of mine, CPC supporter, and he almost cried because I was calling him out. I was cutting through all of his bullshit. He's like, oh, the PPC is over, Greg. Like, they're dead in the water. And I told him, listen, the problem is the Conservative Party doesn't do anything. They're not fighting for anything. We don't like Trudeau because he supports mass migration. We don't like Trudeau because he believes in the United Nations standard. We don't like Trudeau because he shamelessly panders to minorities. Poilievre supports mass migration. He's on board with all the UN stuff. And he shamelessly panders to minorities. These CPC supporters have become so delusional. And I get it, the Trudeau, we gotta get the Trudeau out. And the thing is, this is the same problem that's always been. It's people who are analyzing and they're afraid and they're fearful. I'm not gonna do the right thing. I'm not gonna fight for my country. I'm just gonna sit on the couch. It's the practical thing to do. It's the safe thing to do. My friend said something like, oh, you know, a lot of conservative supporters really like the PPC policies, but, you know, it just doesn't make sense. You know, it's not practical. It can't happen. And this is the attitude of scared people. CPC supporters are scaredy cats. That's literally what defines the people who support this party. And I'm sure in the comments, PPC, national loser, but at least they're doing something. They see that we are at war. Yes, I would call it like a war. It's fifth generational warfare, okay? And at least the PPC is doing something about it. May they have like ways to improve, blah, blah, blah. Sure, but at least they're doing something. At least they're not sitting on the couch, deluding themselves, justifying their fear, justifying the fact that they're a scared pussy, so they don't have to do anything. And they don't have to try to fight for the future of their country or anything at all. And then they just keep feeding this insane delusion. This current era of CPC supporters represents everything that is wrong with Canada. They're scared pussies, they're totally delusional, and they still have faith in this establishment, in these Canadian institutions that have clearly failed us time and time again. So your fear, your passivity, your overanalyzing and then justifying of doing nothing and sitting on the couch, that's how we got to this situation. That's why we're here.
Imagine some person who says, I don't want to work. I want to burn it all down. I don't want to work.
So my ideology can rise.
And you take them seriously, and this is a person that's in charge of, this is a thought person, a person who's in charge of ideas, and a person who's in charge of implementing some sort of a better system for society, for real?
Yeah, no, an ideology is a word people don't understand. I had to read in
it's a cult.
That's the word I was going for. Thank you. It is. It's a cult. It's a cult. Okay, so what it is, ideology is a fancy word for a mythology that the society buys into. That has a direction and it has activity. It's a cult. What we're looking at is the dynamics of a cult. Everything will work out if everybody believes it. We know how it'll work. Nobody else knows how it'll work.
Yeah.
Put us in charge. Obviously, when it doesn't work, somebody else is at fault. That's actually – do you know that that's actually – you can talk to people who still believe that the Soviet Union could have worked out, and they say the reason the communist countries failed – because obviously, you know, there are catastrophes, hundreds of millions dead, nothing works, they collapse. They say that it was because there are capitalist countries pressuring them from the outside that prevent them from working. So you can say – I've had this conversation. So if it can only work if every country is communist, and they're like, that's right. That's a global cult is what that is. That's not real.
We're just so vulnerable. to ideologies, which seems to also be the case. It's why there's so many different sects of religions, even sects of Christianity. The Protestants hated the Catholics forever. The what happened in Iraq with the Sunnis and the Shias. This is always the case.
It's always the case.
People have like really rigid ideologies, and the punishment for abandoning them or the punishment for stepping outside is death. And that is what we're seeing in this country.
That's
we're
right.
seeing this weird leftist, progressive ideology with a super wide net that covers so many things, including all these industries that are set up to make it look like they want a better world, where really they just want to dominate a sector of the market.
So there's this queer educator, which is a fucking weird thing to even say, right? His name's Kevin Kumashiro. And Kevin Kumashiro wrote his paper back in 2002 titled Against Repetition. And in this paper, he actually says that the point of social justice and specifically queer education is to lead children into personal crisis and then structure their environment so they resolve the crisis toward social justice. That's trauma bonding. That's cult recruitment. That should be a prison sentence. Yeah, and I'll tell you, queer theory doesn't have limiting principles. It's opposed to limiting principles on principle. Let me give you another definition. This is a book called Saint Foucault, naming the Michel Foucault, the postmodern guy we made fun of back in the grievance studies papers. And so Michel Foucault is lionized in this book, and this is the book where queer in queer theory gets defined. David Halpern wrote it, 95 is the date, and it's right there in the paragraph that he writes defining queer. It starts with these three words: unlike gay identity. Has virtually nothing to do with gay people. Why? He says, because that's rooted in a positive truth. You're gay, right? That's a truth. You're gay. He says queer need not be grounded, he says, in any positive truth or any stable reality. It is whatever is opposed to the normal, the legitimate, and the dominant. Stability repels revolutions. They need radical people. They need queer activists who want to destabilize the normal and undermine the legitimate at every turn.
Jesus Christ.
And that, like, these people are dead serious, and they are opposed to the idea. So this started by me saying they're opposed to limiting principles on principle. What does that mean? It means at some point, somebody's going to say, you know what? You want to hump kids? No, that's a limiting principle. We draw the line at kids. That's a limiting principle. They're opposed actually to anything that tells them no. Anything in the world, including the world itself, telling them no. Oh, yeah, you know, you technically can't be a man who becomes a woman, but let's just chop you up until you're close enough. The world's telling you no, but we're going to keep doing surgeries and hormones until it's kind of like yes.
That's where religion comes in, because religion does tell you this is a good way to behave and these are the tenets that you should live by. And it's not like this thing that you should be escalating and pushing it further and further and further.
It's like, not to get all like churchy, but I have been. I've seriously, when I said earlier that I've been looking at the Bible a lot, looking at the Gospels, not just particularly, but especially I was reading the Gospel of Matthew the other day, 7th chapter. And I bet you never thought you were going to have this conversation with me. But I was reading it, and I'm reading about the way is narrow, the straight and narrow way, where he has that in Matthew 7. He's like, you know, wide is the path that leads to destruction, but the way that leads to life is straight and narrow. And it's like, well, what is that talking about? It's like, you have to live well. You have to treat each other well. It's like, you have to also repent when you mess up, and people don't like to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just go along with the crowd because the crowd is going in some direction. That's the wide path, and that leads to destruction. But the way is straight and narrow. When he says straight, it's not like straight like straight line. It's straight like a waterway. Like so that means that the edges are like right there. And if you don't run the boat just right, you know, you're going to crash into the sides. So what does religion do? Well, religion teaches people to like at least contemplate this crap. Like, why don't you stop for 5 minutes of your week and think maybe there's some like ways to be a good person?
Right. And if you don't have a structure for that, then it's dependent entirely upon the ideology that you subscribe to.
Right.
And if it's an out of control ideology that may very well be controlled by foreign powers that are using it to disrupt this country.
And then, like, you've got
to. It's a crazy thing to think, but that might really be what's going on.
I think it is.
The problem with religious terminology is that in the field of politics and ethics, it is all approximation or worse. It is not precise or defined in absolute terms that relate to political reality. From the word God to the word faith, each individual has his or her own interpretation of those concepts, possibly quite distinct from one another or even opposed to others who are using the same terminology. Now, James Lindsay cited the Gospel of Matthew, the 7th chapter. The way is narrow and wide is the path that leads to destruction. And he interpreted it as meaning you have to live well and repent when you mess up. And straight means like a waterway. If you don't run the boat just right, you will crash. Just right. That's right. In politics, to say that the way is narrow refers to the politics being just right. Freedom and capitalism. This is a very narrow and principled and reality-based way of thinking and acting, in accordance with reality and with reason. Why it is the path that leads to destruction refers to the politics of the left, where there are so many variants of collectivism. I talk about this all the time. Socialism, communism, communitarianism, fascism, and on and on and on, because none of them are real. They are all the products of the primacy of consciousness, where you can just make anything up without having to validate it against what is known to be right. So, why do so many applied theories, quote-unquote, fail to result in their intended outcomes? For a simple reason. The theories are based on a mode of thinking, philosophically, referred to as the primacy of consciousness, which stands in direct opposition to the primacy of existence. These concepts are so important, I would almost devote every episode of this show to them because they're so fundamental to understanding why people vote and act the way they do. The primacy of consciousness and the primacy of existence are the fundamental metaphysical roots underlying any system of thinking or belief. The primacy of existence operates on the notion that the universe exists independent of consciousness, of any consciousness, that things are what they are, that they possess a specific nature, an identity. To identify these properties of existence requires a philosophy that seeks to further our understanding of the nature of the universe and existence. The political polarity of this view of existence is called the right. Now, the primacy of consciousness operates on the notion that the universe has no independent existence, that it is the product of a consciousness, either human or divine or both. And any theories of existence based on this premise cannot properly be called philosophies, but are rather ideologies, which require no validation by any independent external existent. The political polarity of this view of existence is the left. It should therefore come as no surprise that all such ideologies fail in practice, without exception. Socialism and its variants are always 100% failures at improving the lives of anyone but a handful of tyrants. Consequently, all quote-unquote philosophies of the left cannot be classified as valid or legitimate philosophies at all because they have no bearing on the facts of reality or the process of reason. The term ideology places ideas and thought ahead of all other considerations, no matter whether real or imaginary. I mean, the very term ideology screams of the primacy of consciousness. Many who desire solutions that are practical rather than philosophical may be confusing philosophy with ideology, or they may simply wish to dispense with the effort required by philosophy, a mode of thought that is disciplined by the facts of reality. And unless a philosophy proves itself to be just right in practice, it cannot be considered a philosophy at all, but is mere ideology. Now consider some of the descriptions of ideology offered by Joe Rogan and James Lindsay. Ideology is a word people don't understand. It's a cult, a fancy word for mythology. We are so vulnerable to ideology, sects of religions, always the case, rigid ideologies, punishment is death, leftist progressive ideology. And then they observe that these people are dead serious. They are opposed to limiting principles on principle, opposed to anything that tells them no, including the world itself. So in other words, they're opposed to reality. Everything emanates from the mind. A perfect word for describing that kind of thinking is ideology. Now, these observations are all quite valid, but do not identify the cause of why people believe in cults and ideologies. The cause, again, is that they operate on the primacy of consciousness. They think that reality is determined by their thoughts and beliefs, rather than accept the reality that one's thoughts and beliefs have to be in accordance with what exists and with what is real. And if that's not the case, then those thoughts, beliefs, and even feelings, as we demonstrated recently, are simply not valid and should never be blindly followed or advocated. Now, one of the fundamental differences between left and right is that those on the left, who operate on the primacy of consciousness, are always trying to change humanity itself in such a way as to align human nature with their own inhuman ideas, their ideology, ideas which they hold to be superior to reality and reason, and they don't care about other people. In contrast, those on the right accept human nature as it is and seek to mold politics into a discipline that acknowledges human nature. And now, coming up next, from a March 14th, 2020 posting of Philosophy Insights, Ayn Rand herself speaking to the real motive for the socialist mindset, which of course necessarily includes a discussion about the primacy of consciousness.
Whenever any issue is misrepresented for a long, long time, whenever you see people distorting facts, refusing to abide by facts, and not making any sense in their accusations, you may be sure that the reasons they state are not their true reasons, and that there is something deeper behind it which they do not care to admit. This is particularly true in the case of capitalism. Capitalism has been misrepresented practically from its inception, both by its enemies and its alleged defenders. But the amount of distortion and misrepresentation which goes on today, even though evidence to the contrary is available and is accumulating year by year, is truly staggering. It is perhaps the single most misrepresented issue in cultural history. Therefore, it is important to ask ourselves, what are people's real reasons? When people are blind to the truth, obviously blind, when the issue is not merely an error of knowledge, is not a matter of ignorance, but of psychological vested interests, we have to ask, what are the vested interests behind people's attitude? And in the case of capitalism, the very obvious psychological root is man's fear of independence. Fear of independence, first of all, and consequently, fear of rationality. An anti-rational mentality is necessary to be anti-capitalist. And on a more formal level, these psychological evils unite in support of the morality of altruism. People are led to hate capitalism to the extent to which they subscribe to the altruist morality. In many cases, they would feel dimly, because they would be evading the issue and trying not to admit it, they would feel that there is a bad clash between the conventional morality which they have been taught to accept, which they're not independent nor brave enough to reject, and a clash between that and the nature of capitalism. In that sense, the nature of reality. They are caught between the fact of a false moral theory, which they dare not challenge, namely altruism, and the facts of reality, which demonstrate over and over again that capitalism is the best, the most practical, and the most moral, in fact, the only moral system in human history. People dare not face that dichotomy because capitalism is incompatible with the morality of altruism. And those who have accepted that morality have such a psychological vested interest in it that they take their inner conflict out on capitalism. They make capitalism the whipping boy of their own inner contradictions. They know, in a psychological sense, subconsciously, that they are wrong in regard to altruism, and they therefore acquire a vested interest to try to prove that capitalism is evil. If they can discredit capitalism, they can consider themselves free to pursue their own impractical, vicious morality. That is in terms of moral considerations. But deeper than that is, of course, the question, what attracts them to the morality of altruism? Why has morality been perpetuated for such a long time in spite of its obvious evils and blatant contradictions? And here we come to the issue I named first, that is people's fear of independence, fear of relying on their own judgment, on their own mind, and therefore feel fear of reason. It is their subconscious and sometimes conscious desire to permit a loophole to their irrationality. It is their reluctance to be at the mercy of an absolute reality. It is a desire to bypass reality in some way, to cut corners, to have an escape clause for their whims, their wishes, their fears, and the irrational element within them. What they fear when they fear capitalism is objectivity, rationality, and reality.
Ms. Rand, would you elaborate the relationship between subjectivism, the view that reality is not perceived by consciousness but is created by consciousness, and the idea of statism, which seems to be in large degree based on the idea that if the government sets about to do something, that it can automatically achieve its ends irrespective of the facts of reality?
Well, you have really named the essence of the question here. Those who want to escape from reason and reality can do so only by means of hoping that their hopes, wishes, or fears can somehow triumph over reality, that one does not have to be bound by facts, that one's wishes can somehow succeed, regardless of whether they correspond to the facts of reality or contradict them. In such a case, the only excuse, not moral excuse, but psychological semblance of an excuse for such people is the fact that most of their desires and their irrationality takes place in the social context, and that if they wish something which is contrary to the facts, society, meaning other people, will somehow provide it. If they act irrationally, other people will save them from the consequences of their irrationality. If they demand the irrational or the unearned, other people will provide it. As Mr. Brandon said once, anyone who introduces a somehow into his idea of the means of achieving his ends always means somebody. And this is the clue to the statist psychology. They hope that by enslaving the producers of the goods in life, the economic producers, by creating an omnipotent state which will rule everybody's life, they, the irrationalists, will somehow ride on the shoulders of the rational members of society, the productive members, those able to deal with the facts of reality properly, not only in the issue of producing material goods, material wealth, but in all issues. If these providers are enslaved by the state, then their energy and their productiveness will permit the irrationalist to gain the unearned. The unearned in matter, in the form of unearned wealth, and the unearned in spirit, in the form of unearned honors or government positions. The sole means to achieve the unearned, not to achieve it because one can't, but to attempt to achieve it, is by means of physical force, which is why the enemies of capitalism are statists. There is no alternative to a free society except the establishment of a totalitarian state, which is the rule of men by force. When force is the standard of social relationships, then the irrational man may hope that somehow, by force, his masters will provide him with what he wants, will take care of him. He is willing to give total obedience to the state in exchange for the state saving him from the problem which he dreads most. That is the problem of facing life on his own, the problem of taking the responsibility for his own life, his own actions, and his own judgment. That is what he dreads, and his sole recourse, since there is in fact no escape from reality, is to hide behind those men whom he observes around him, who are able to deal with reality, who are not afraid to think, who act on their judgment and produce all values that men have ever achieved intellectually or materially. It is these men that the irrationalist wants to enslave and force somehow to provide for him. This theme, of course, is clearly illustrated in Atlas Shrugged.
You're listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. When Rand was asked to elaborate on subjectivism, where reality is not perceived by consciousness, but is created by consciousness, this, of course, was a direct reference to the primacy of consciousness. Now, I have to confess, when I first learned about the primacy of consciousness and what it meant in practice, I thought it was an insane theory. Turns out it wasn't the theory that was insane, it was the people who actually do think that way who are insane, meaning they're utterly out of touch with reality. Surely, such people are an insignificant minority in society, I assumed. How could any sane person possibly believe that existence and reality are products of their own subjective consciousness? Do they honestly believe that when they die and their consciousness ceases to operate, that the rest of us and the whole world and all of existence will cease to exist? Of course, it will for them. You can't have a consciousness without having something to be conscious of. This is why the primacy of existence ruled supreme and must precede any notions of consciousness. But I know now that the number of people who operate on the primacy of consciousness are an overwhelming number, comprised of all those certainly on the left polarity in politics. These are the friends of socialism and tyranny and the enemies of capitalism and freedom. And they spread their evil through the ideology of altruism, which they present to the public as a philosophy of caring for the welfare of others. You know, wear your mask and get an injection and stay at home in order to protect granny. Which speaks to Rand's comment that those who have accepted altruism as morality make capitalism their enemy. They know that they are wrong, so they try to prove capitalism is evil. But the question that begs asking is, how can we know that altruists themselves know that they are wrong? Well, I addressed this issue way back in July of 22 in the context of definitions and gender. I argued that everyone is quote-unquote hardwired to reality. And that's because reality exists, and every functioning human mind is hardwired to that reality, a connection that persists even in the attempt to deny or avoid it. The creation of definitions that do not correspond to reality, that is, existence, or to reason, has been the primary political weapon of all those who operate on the primacy of consciousness. It should not be surprising, then, that those who operate on false and incorrect definitions feel threatened by words like truth or by the reality that there is only one reality. Since the purpose of concepts and consciousness is to identify elements of reality, a mistaken or false concept can lead to dire consequences, including even death. Capitalism, of course, is that economic system that arises naturally in a free society, in a society that is free from coercion. But then there's democracy and the forms of government that can accommodate it. To judge by last week's democratic victory of Vladimir Putin over his political opponents, it's clear that some form of democracy is emerging in Russia. Voting, on the other hand, occurs in almost all countries and nations, even the most tyrannical. But that's not democracy. Putin won the Russian elections with over 87% of the votes cast. And as Mike Jones, independent reporter inside Russia, speaking to Redacted's Natalie Morris, pointed out on March 18th, the idea that Putin didn't have any opposition is preposterous. The second largest party in Russia is the Communist Party, and guess how many votes it got? 4%. And based on his report, it certainly appears that Putin has the overwhelming consent of the governed in his country. America's Joe Biden doesn't even come close to that kind of support. He is hated by a majority of the governed in the U.S. In talking to the average man and woman on the streets of Russia, Jones reported that virtually all of them supported Putin. So, can we now declare Russia to be a democracy? And how can the West reconcile its ridiculous belief that Ukraine is a democracy when Ukraine doesn't even allow elections? So this brings us to take a closer look at the concept of democracy itself. People who say that democracy is simply majority rule are using that term democracy in the exact way that Joe Biden is using it, the freedom to vote. And in his case, he's talking about the freedom to vote against freedom, not for it. But democracy is really more about the consent of the governed, and consent does not require voting at all, really. Voting is about consensus, which is majority rule. A government of the people, by the people, and for the people is one that operates on the principle of consent, which requires a political environment of freedom, as we shall discover right after we return from this following bumper break, beginning with Sky News Australia's James Morrow on a woke meltdown over Donald Trump, and ending with Awaken with JP, who demonstrates why trustworthy lies are good for you.
But first, tell you what, if Donald Trump had a superpower, it would have to be his ability to drive his opponents into absolute full-on meltdown, making them so angry that they reveal what they really think. Have a look at this woke influencer having an absolute meltdown about, oh no, Donald Trump's campaign promises. And as you do, ask yourself, what's the problem with these?
Here are the first 15 promises he has made if he is reelected. You may have heard of Project 2025, but this is from Agenda 47. And you can read all of these on his website. First, he promises that he will carry out the largest domestic deportation operation in history.
He's already got my vote. What are you doing?
Don't promise me
a good time.
He will close the Department of Education and return all education standards to the states to decide. He will put prayer back into school, and he will criminalize any race-based advantage programs. He will end the Affordable Care Act. He will ban gender-affirming care for adults and children, and he will ban any federal dollars from going towards gender-affirming care, which means anyone with government-provided health care will no longer be able to access gender-affirming care except for Viagra and Cialis. Those will still be available. He will propose a constitutional amendment that gives a term limit to Congress. He will deploy the Department of Justice to investigate the Biden crime family and any of his adversaries or political rivals. He will immediately pardon all of the January Sixers, and he will create a task force to investigate anyone who arrested, charged, or imprisoned a January Sixer. He will increase the penalties for underage criminal offenders, strengthen immunity for police officers, and deploy the National Guard to patrol woke cities.
Hey, what a legend.
Stop. We can only get so excited here. So let's get this straight. I mean, deportations of illegals, criminalizing divisive DEI nonsense, getting rid of the education bureaucracy that is making American kids as stupid and jelly-brained as Joe Biden. Congressional term limits? Finally investigating the Bidens properly? Whew, I'm sorry, I watched that whole video to the end and there was a lot more. Amazingly, I didn't see any authorization from the Trump campaign there, which is funny because that looked an awful lot like an ad for Donald Trump, not a rant on TikTok against him.
Edge scientific breakthrough. We've just discovered what everyone but line-toeing liberals have known for the past 4 years. COVID isn't a serious, deadly pandemical killer. Tonight, we'll be giving you a full report on why COVID should be treated like the flu, give you a brief history of how we were in your face 24/7 telling you the opposite of that, and we'll also exercise enough narcissism to convince you that we always have been and will continue to be credible. That's right. It just so happens to turn out that COVID is kind of like the flu mixed with bird poop funded by Fauci during an election year in a lab. But make no mistake, it's still so deadly that now isn't the time to let off the accelerator towards your 27th booster, because the world's still overpopulated. Taking a walk through memory lane. Do you remember this post from Trump that had to be removed from Facebook, because it was dangerous misinformation, and now we're telling you the same thing? Well, try not to remember it if you would. It kind of makes us look inconsistent and uncredible while making him look incredible. And for the record, his post is still considered misinformation. If you look at the fine print, you'll see why. As you've outsourced your health to us in the media over the past 4 years, which is wise to do because we've never done a single personal evaluation on your health, we're funded by the pharmaceutical industry, and we're not doctors. You might be sitting there asking, how come all my conservative friends and family, whose relationships I ruined because they thought COVID was no more serious than the flu, knew this cutting-edge medical discovery 4 years ago, and I didn't? The answer to that is they didn't. Because they're evil, they thought it was deadlier than you did, and they didn't want you to protect yourself from it by ruining your life to save your life because they wanted you to die. Trust us on that. Because we couldn't have misled you further over the past 4 years, we're probably leading you correctly now. So it's actually a good thing that we were able to help motivate you to destroy your friendships and relationships with your family. We helped protect you. Marxism. Divide the people to control the people. Don't you feel protected? And perhaps you also finally remember this state-sponsored video from the CDC aimed at kids to get them to turn their neighbors in by fighting online disinformation about COVID.
In many cases, the authors of this misinformation are simply misinformed.
The deadliest form of disinformation is the type that's correct. Never trust it.
The Center for Disease Control and Prevention website should be favored because they are a trustworthy source. Due to large government funding, Susan eventually tracks down a fact-based source that compares flu and COVID deaths during the same period.
Remember how there were all of a sudden no cases of the flu during that period? I still wonder why that was.
Meanwhile, Susan's uncle has been doing his own research.
Susan's uncle sounds like he's been listening to RFK Jr.
He's encountered many so-called sources that contain disinformation. Take this fake news story, for example. It claims to cite an official source, the CDC, but it misrepresents the data. This video also uses emotional and sensational elements instead of a fact-based argument.
Using facts that we made up to compel your actions from fear is the way to avoid these emotional and sensational elements.
But you can protect yourself from disinformation. You can stop it from spreading too.
You can stop it from spreading too.
Report the disinformation. Thus we prove that those who turn in their neighbors are always on the right side of history. Now to the question on your mind. Why did it take us 4 years to discover the basic facts on COVID? Well, we've been moving at the speed of science on this one, ladies and gentlemen, and unfortunately common sense may move at the infinite speed of now, but the speed of science moves at the speed of influencing the next election. Accordingly, in the upcoming days, we'll be crediting Joseph R. Biden with conquering the pandemic. As soon as he figures out how to find his way back into the house from the backyard and stumbles in with his underwear probably on backwards, if on at all, we'll give him his award. At this point in the playbook, we expect your common sense to be asking, What about all the people who died while on ventilators and taking remdesivir? Did they really have to die? Answer, yes they did. Remember, they died with COVID, so we needed them to. Plus, this flu-like virus that doesn't destroy kidneys because it's like the flu definitely used to destroy kidneys on purpose, but it doesn't anymore. Why not? Well, you'll really appreciate the science on this. We'll be answering no further questions on that. Another contributing factor that's helped the people that tell us what to say discover that they want us to say that COVID should be treated like the flu now is that another election year is upon us. And if you were being instructed to focus your fear on COVID, you'll have less fear bandwidth to focus on what we're bringing to you next. Will it be Disease X? Smallpox? We're not going to spoil it for you yet, but we've already told you that those are killing 100% of humanized mice. This just in! A question from a viewer. Why the f*** do you guys have humanized mice? No comment. But stand by and wait for your instructions on what to focus all your fear on next so that the leash that we control you with can be wrapped tightly around your neck. Whatever the next one is, we can assure you that part of the cure will be mail-in ballots. That's it for today's news. You have permission to relax for a couple weeks before the next demon arises from the sea that you are to worship. By the way, please don't read the Book of Revelations. It's nothing more than disinformation. Good night!
Wow, I can imagine Ayn Rand turning over in her grave in light of how far society has allowed itself to become so utterly irrational on so immense a scale. But as I said before the break, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people is one that operates on the principle of consent, which requires a political environment of freedom. And I thought I would wrap up today's show by sharing with you the following commentary that illustrates that very point. The late David Pengelly was president of the Freedom Party of Ontario's Don Mills Constituency Association in the early 1990s. The following essay, from which I shall quote, was originally published in the October 1990 issue of Scarborough West Perspectives and then reprinted in Freedom Party's Journal of Ideas and Opinions, consent number 15, in January of 1992, which is still available on Freedom Party's website today. For those seeking some kind of reconciliation between the concepts of freedom and democracy, this might be the best source you'll ever find. And not surprisingly, the essay was entitled Freedom and Democracy, with an emphasis on the word and. And I quote, Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms tells us our rights are subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. Why our rights should be limited is questionable. But what is also interesting is that the words free and democratic were used, not just democratic. This is because freedom and democracy are not synonyms. They do not mean the same things. Democracy is government by the people or government by majority vote. In Canada, we exercise this by electing our governments, who then can do pretty much what they want until the next election. As an example, the Federal Progressive Conservatives supported the Goods and Services Tax, the GST, which is opposed by a majority of the adult population. Of course, we can throw them out of office again the next election, but there's no guarantee that the new government will cut spending or get rid of the tax. This is a negative limit to democracy. At the same time, democracy needs positive limits. This, I believe, is the reason that democracy was linked with freedom in the Charter. Freedom consists of not existing or acting under compulsion. This lack of compulsion includes having such rights as freedom of speech, religion, association, the right to peaceful use of private property, and equality before the law. If we are to be a free society, then you, or a government, cannot force me to act in the way you wish, and I cannot force you to act in the way I wish. By limiting democracy, by saying our society is also free, we have aid in preventing injustices. For example, suppose a party ran on a platform and received 60% of the votes and got 60% of the seats. That is a democratically elected government, and it can pass the laws that implement its platform. But suppose that those laws called for putting all Jews in concentration camps and confiscating their property. That would certainly not be a free society, and therefore the law would be illegal even if it was supported by a majority of people. Democracy needs to be tethered by freedom. Enemies of freedom use the words freedom and democracy to mean the same thing, majority rule. Whenever our rights are threatened, they say, but it's democratic, it's the will of the majority. Well, it may be, but does it preserve freedom? Why freedom? Some people ask, what is so important about freedom? They would be willing to give it up if they could get security and prosperity. But this is a fatal delusion, since it is freedom that creates prosperity, and prosperity which allows people to be secure. People work best when they are aiming for a goal that they value. To do this, they must be assured that if they reach their goal, they will be allowed to keep it, and not have it taken from them. This requires individual freedom. It is better to have millions of citizens working for their individual prosperity than to have thousands of government employees working for theirs. Why then democracy? Democracy has proven to be the system that protects freedom the longest. In other systems, freedom is very insecure. If an oligopoly rules, for example, a small number of rich families, there is little to prevent them from using the government to enrich the controlling members. In a monarchy, the ruler could protect freedom, but rulers die, and the heir may be a tyrant. In a democracy, however, you must delude the people to legislate away their freedom. It can take generations to completely destroy it. In the meantime, it may be possible to educate voters to realize the threats and vote for freedom instead of big government, thus turning back the tide. Readers will realize that I think freedom is under siege in Canada. To gain security, people have voted away much of their freedom. Trying to provide this security, governments are heavily in debt. The currency is being destroyed by inflation. High taxes and government regulation are having their effects, and business is having trouble competing. Unemployment is high. Despite massive government welfare programs, there are more poor than ever. This is a result of the loss of our freedom. We must use democracy to get it back. End quote. Wow, couldn't have said it better myself. You know, we can write the most perfect constitutions, bills of rights, codes of conduct that one might imagine, but unless the culture for which they are written supports and abides by those principles, they aren't worth the paper they're written on. To effect political change, that is, a change from the current direction of left to the desired direction of right, you have to start somewhere. We don't need a majority, we need an alternative. When you consider how many people on the right are scaredy cats, quote unquote, and even reluctant to freely cast a single Democratic vote for a party they say they agree with, then consider the difficulty involved in getting them to volunteer for tasks that demand more time of them than simply voting. Like, for example, choosing to spend an hour with us again next week, which you are invited to do as we continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
Okay, please, everybody, listen up, huh? Now, I'm going to need volunteers for these various committees. First, food. Now, who volunteered to take care of the grub? Well, what the heck, I can do this one, Ernie Pantuzzo. I did a pretty good job last year. At least no one complained. This brings us to the entertainment committee. Who wants to chair this baby? Well, entertainment goes right along with food. Ernie Patches. Now, we'll need two captains for the softball teams. Two. Come on, a show of hands, huh? Well, I can handle one team, Ernie Pantuzzo. Okay, so who wants the other? One more. Well, I'm going to be out there on the field anyway, so... Ernie Pantuso. Oh, and last but not least, I need somebody to head up transportation. I got it. Ernie Pantuso. Now, there'll be a meeting of the committee chairman at my house tonight at 8 o'clock. Please, everybody, try to be on time, huh?